debates, town halls, and one-on-one interviews. It's down to the wire to reach out to the voters for their support as the first votes are cast in the 2024 presidential election.
We have a rich tradition rooted in the gospel and our social teaching to make the world a better place.
What's a Catholic voter to do? Some advice and guidance ahead.
And when they interviewed me, they said, would you consider becoming a priest? And I was 13 years old.
We sit down with America's youngest Catholic bishop, Joseph Espaillat of the Bronx. Known for his outreach to young people, he shares his secret to successful evangelization.
I hope to stay alive and stay on fire for Jesus Christ.
And tapping into the minds of young Catholics as thousands gather to focus on what they're seeking in their lives. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
The most important issue. And that is the character of the candidate. You don't know what's going to come across the next president's desk. You think you can predict it, but you can't.
The race for the Republican presidential nomination narrows as former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie announced on Wednesday his decision to suspend his campaign just days before the first votes are cast in the Iowa caucus and 2 weeks before the New Hampshire primary. A fierce critic of former President Donald Trump, he kept up his warnings about returning him to the White House in his parting town hall with voters. As he took the stage on the same day, so did those who remain in the race. GOP frontrunner Donald Trump in a Fox town hall and challengers Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis in a CNN debate. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. The election season begins in earnest this coming week, when voters cast their first ballots of the 2024 presidential race. The Iowa Republican caucuses are on Monday night. With sub-zero temperatures predicted, it will be the most dedicated voters who brave the cold to participate. The beginning election calendar looks like this. On the Republican side, the Iowa caucus is on January 15th, followed by the New Hampshire primary on January 23rd, the Nevada and Virgin Islands caucuses on February 8th, and the South Carolina primary on February 24th. Voters casting ballots for Democrats get started a little later. The New Hampshire primary on January 23rd is first up, followed by the South Carolina primary on February 3rd and Nevada primary on February 6th. The Democrats and Republicans' schedules match up when both have primaries in Michigan on February 27th. In a flurry of appearances, the Republican candidates went before the cameras in several venues, trying to appeal to voters for their support. Former President Donald Trump remains way ahead of his competition in the polls and chose not to appear with his GOP rivals on stage, something both Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis called out in their debate on CNN on Wednesday evening.
I wish Donald Trump was up here on this stage. He's the one that I'm running against. He's the one that I wish would be here. He needs to be defending his record. Right now, he's not defending the fact that he allowed us to have $8 trillion in debt over 4 years that our kids are never going to forgive us for.
I do agree with her on this. Donald Trump should be on this stage. Every candidate needs to earn your vote. Nobody's entitled to your vote. And he comes in here every now and then. He does his spiel and then he leaves. I've shown up to all 99 counties because it's important. You're a servant of the people. You are not a ruler over the people.
In a spirited debate, there was not much else Haley and DeSantis agreed on, repeatedly accusing each other of lying about their records. Both were asked about their stance on abortion and whether they thought former President Trump is truly pro-life after calling Florida and Iowa's six-week heartbeat laws terrible.
You'd have to ask him. That's why he should be on this debate stage. Don't ask me what President Trump thinks. You need to have him on this debate stage and ask him for yourself.
He was at the March for Life when he was president his last year, and he said that life's a gift from God, that the unborn are made in the image of God, and that you needed to have protections for that human life. And now saying it's a terrible, terrible thing. He's given a gift to the left to weaponize that against pro-lifers, and that's wrong. But here's the thing. Republicans need to do a better job of lifting up folks who are having children. It's very difficult to raise kids in this environment. You need to help with medical care. You need to help with affordability, and we need to help with education choice. You got to be pro-life for the whole life, and you got to have some compassion for what is going on in this country.
Thank you, Governor.
These fellas don't know how to talk about abortion. I've said over and over again, the Democrats put fear in women on abortion, and Republicans have used judgment. This is too personal of an issue to put fear or judgment. Our goal should be, how do we save as many babies as possible and support as many moms as possible? That's what we're going to focus on doing. We're not going to demonize this issue anymore. We're not going to play politics with this issue anymore. We're going to treat it like the respectful issue that it is.
In the Fox Town Hall the same evening, an Iowa voter asked the former president about why he blamed pro-lifers for some of the election losses around the country and criticized heartbeat laws. She asked him whether he could reassure her that he would protect all life without compromise. After claiming credit for overturning Roe v. Wade, he said he is for the exceptions of rape, incest, and the life of the mother. And he added some people don't know they're pregnant at 6 weeks.
I want to get something where people are happy. You know, this has been tearing our country apart for 50 years. Nobody's been able to do anything. And again, you can only ask that question, and you ask it brilliantly. And I understand exactly where you're coming from. I love where you're coming from. But we still have to win elections.
He said, quote, there has to be a little bit of a concession one way or the other. Before the debate on Wednesday, Governor DeSantis welcomed EWTN News into the governor's mansion in Tallahassee, where I asked him more about his abortion stance and about how his faith informs his politics.
I really believe in the power of prayer. And it's, you know, you do have kind of a feeling, it's kind of a calmness just to know that, you know, ultimately we're in this world, but we're not of this world. And every single day when you're in this political thicket, they're throwing stuff at you, shooting at you, all this stuff, trying to kind of divert you off course of taking you away from that true north. And I think just being able to pray, being able to be in touch with the Lord, it just gives you a way to just know none of that stuff really matters. None of that stuff matters. And I can also tell you just in trials and tribulations that we've had, you know, when my wife in 2021 got diagnosed with breast cancer, at the time we had a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. And so those types of diagnoses are hard for anyone. But I think especially when you have a mother of really young kids, to be in a situation where, you know, you could be, you know, having an incident where she may not get through that, and then these kids would grow up without a mother. It's very, very shocking when that happens. It was really tough for us when we got the news. But I'll tell you this, the people that prayed for us over those weeks and months had a huge impact, and it really lifted my wife's spirits. She had to go through a lot of really, really tough stuff. But she was able to do it. I obviously, as the husband and the father, was there to be supportive. And she ended up coming out of that, I would say, probably stronger now as a result. Not, you know, she would never wish any of that, anyone go through that. But I think she would tell you she's stronger as a result of having done that.
It's hard to hear a lot of people say that through trials and tribulations, thank God, it allows you to rediscover faith, to rediscover his face in your life. Would you say that it made you a better man to go through those trials and tribulations, taking, you know, the hand of God?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think that, you know, it's a time where you kind of got to dig deep. You know, you can think like, well, why would God allow this to happen? But, you know, these are things that we have to go through, and we all have different roadblocks. There's different pitfalls in life. It's not just a gold-plated road that you never have a care in the world. I mean, this is what you have to deal with. And that's really a time, I think, where your faith is tested. Some people turn away as a result of that because they're bitter that something happened. And I think my wife and I, you know, we were, you know, more solid in our faith as a result of that.
You can imagine why voters would be interested in knowing everything about your life, since celebrity candidates have become really the thing. I mean, with Hillary, with Obama, you had the rise of the celebrity candidate, but also the rise of candidates who portray themselves as people of faith, but aren't necessarily really that in their hearts. What kind of an answer do you have to that curiosity?
Well, I think one of the things that we bring, my wife and I, is this country has a crisis of family disintegration. You have forces that are actively hostile to family, trying to undermine rights of parents. I mean, I had a debate with the governor of California, and I pointed out in California law, they allow minors from other states behind their parents' back to go into California and get gender surgeries, which is basically mutilation. It's terrible. Parents don't even consent or know about this. That is a direct attack on parents and on family. And then we have so many kids that grow up without a father in the household. We've done a lot in Florida to launch a fatherhood initiative to raise the importance of fatherhood, to make sure folks know they have responsibilities. But then also in situations where it's just not possible to have a father present, sometimes fathers are in prison, to promote mentorship. Because some of these kids, if someone takes an interest in their life, that could be the difference between them being productive or going in a really bad direction. So I think one of the things we bring is we show the importance of family.
You've discussed the life issue, and your stance on that is clear. Obviously, the life issue is very important to you. You're very pro-life, and you've gone back and forth on the best ways to protect life, a 6-week ban, a 15-week ban, whatever it is. Is it because it's personal to you? And have you taken losses because you're pro-life?
Well, look, part of it is just who I am and believing in a culture of life. But part of it is also understanding the way America was organized. I mean, the Declaration of Independence says that we are endowed not by government, but by God with certain inalienable rights. And the beginning of that is the right to life itself. And so the purpose of government is to protect the rights that we have. And so when you have a situation where you clearly have a separate human being, you know, at what point are we going to act like that there shouldn't be legal protections? And, you know, yes, prior to the Dobbs decision, Florida enacted a 15-week where unborn were protected at 15 weeks, which was fine. But that's like only 4 or 5% of all babies. And so the heartbeat bill that was done provides, you know, more robust protections and will end up saving a lot of lives. How that factors in politically, I think on issues that are fundamental, you know, why are you in office? Are you in office to put your finger in the wind and try to contort yourself into a pretzel? Or are you in office to be able to stand up for things that you believe in?
Do you feel like there's pressure from the elites or from the establishment, even within your own party, to cave on issues of gender ideology or abortion?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I've had folks say that they wanted to support me for president financially, but they didn't like the fact that we battled Disney to fight against the gender ideology. We actually banned the mutilation surgeries in Florida for minors. I mean, think about it. You're talking about 12, 13, 14-year-old kids doing these life-altering, irreversible procedures. And what happens is, as people get older, the dysphoria resolves itself a lot of times. It's like 80, 90% of it. It gets resolved by the time people become adults. And yet they've had these things done to them, which they can't change. Think about it. A 14-year-old would not be able to get a tattoo. A 14-year-old would not be able to sit at a bar and take a shot of whiskey, but yet somehow they could have their private parts taken off. It doesn't make any sense. It's been very, very harmful, and we've taken a strong stand.
The last 10, 15 years in the United States have seen significant challenges around religious freedom, around the contraceptive mandate, Obamacare. Do you think that the Supreme Court, now that Dobbs is the law of the land, is going to play the same role in the future of the country? Is it as important?
Well, certainly on religious freedom, we are not where we need to be. I mean, this country was founded on the idea that your right to the free exercise of religion is endowed by God and cannot be infringed by the government. Now, that was different from what was the norm prior to America, where you basically had toleration of religion, which meant elites would set boundaries as to your practice. But if your religion infringed on their agenda, you were expected to bend the knee to them. What we have in modern America is not an establishment of religion, of Christianity or traditional faith. What you have is elites trying to establish a religion of secular humanism. And they want that to govern society. And so people of faith, Coach Kennedy in Washington State, he says a prayer at midfield after a high school football game, and he loses his job. Now, yes, he goes up to the Supreme Court and he wins, but the fact that that's even a case shows you that religious freedom is very much up for grabs. So I think the leftist elites in this country, they really want to go back to an era of religious toleration. Yeah, go to church on Sunday. They're fine with that, but they don't want you to bring that outside of church. They don't want you to actually live your faith. And if anything that your faith would conflict with their agenda, they would absolutely expect you to bow down. I mean, for example, Supreme Court did the 303 Creative and Masterpiece Cake Shop cases, where you had people bring suits because they were being forced to do messaging that they disagreed with and that violated their conscience or their faith. And they wanted the Supreme Court 6-3, but you know, the three liberal justices would have allowed government to compel them to speak in ways they disagreed with. That is not what our founding fathers intended. So we need an era of religious flourishing in this country. I think the Supreme Court has done much better on these cases than they were doing 30 or 40 years ago, but there's a lot more to do. And it's not just the court, it's also how you operate government. For example, In our programs here, my wife launched a program called Hope Florida. Somebody goes in for government services, we have something called a care portal where we've invited the faith community to be a part of this. So churches can be plugged in, as well as nonprofits and businesses and individuals. So if somebody, say a mother gets evicted from an apartment, she's got two young kids, she shows up, she needs help. Well, just giving a check, that ultimately is not going to really change the trajectory of that woman's life. But if the church comes in, well, then all of a sudden, you know, you have a support system. You know, it's not just statecraft, it's soulcraft. And you have people that usually don't go back then for government assistance because they're on a pathway to prosperity. So as president, I'm going to bring the faith community in and enlist their help to be able to lift people up. I think that that's something that's had great success in Florida. There's a lot of resistance to that on the far left. But the reality is government bureaucracies cannot solve these problems. You need to utilize all the resources available in our communities. And the faith community has an enormous amount of resources and potential to help people.
EWTN News will be closely monitoring this election season. The debates, candidate interviews, polling, and analysis, all from a Catholic perspective. So how will you make your decision about who to vote for and which issues to prioritize? Some guidance for Catholic voters next.
It is very important to be a voice in the political arena on topics that affect our faith.
We talk to some Catholic voters and explore advice from the U.S. Bishops Conference.
And people think, well, yeah, I went to Mass. But did you receive Jesus? You know, did you receive our Lord? You're not going to receive Jesus sitting at home.
Bishop Joseph Espaillat tells us why it's so important to be present and show up for God. Our On the Record interview coming up. And later,
more than 18,000 people registered to be here at SEEK, college-age Catholics from all over the country gathered in St. Louis for a week-long spiritual conference.
Our Mark Irons takes us to the grand experience called SEEK as he talks to hundreds of young Catholics about their faith. We'll be right back. Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. As we enter the presidential election season, with first votes being cast in caucuses and primaries this month, some guidance for Catholic voters from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Rizal Regis tells us about voting priorities in this Catholic Life report.
After some debate, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops has spoken. The threat of abortion remains its preeminent priority this election season. In a new introductory letter to its voter guide titled Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship, the conference states, "The threat of abortion remains our preeminent priority because it directly attacks our most vulnerable and voiceless brothers and sisters and destroys more than a million lives per year in our country alone." At a press conference in November during the USCCB's annual fall assembly, USCCB Vice President Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore explains, "Women in difficult pregnancies and their unborn children need our support now more than ever."
So it's not simply a public policy issue. It is a deeply, deeply pastoral issue of loving the moms in need, walking with them, helping them bring their babies to term, and then providing them with what they need to move forward.
The bishops also wrote euthanasia, gun violence, terrorism, the death penalty, and human trafficking as other grave threats to life and dignity of the human person. Other issues listed in the letter include redefinition of marriage and gender, threats to religious freedom, lack of justice for the poor, suffering of migrants and refugees, wars and famines, racism, need for greater access to health care and education, and care for our common home.
The teaching document Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship is meant to advise Catholic voters on how to apply church teaching to their political choices.
Not simply to ask themselves, who's my favorite candidate, who do I like, what kind of ideology attracts me, but rather to step back and say, what does my church say? What does our tradition say about the public order and what is good and true and right and just?
In addition to the new letter now available for Catholic voters, supplemental inserts will also be disseminated in parish bulletins nationwide before the 2024 election. The bishops also voted to postpone writing a full revision of the teaching document until after the election this year. This is a first, as the bishops have updated Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship every 4 years since it was first issued in 2007. USCCB Associate General Secretary for Policy and Advocacy Anthony Granado explains what to expect.
It's unclear which direction and how that will look, but there will be a definite contemplative and deliberative process amongst the bishops with the consultants to look at what the new document might look like.
We asked several Catholic voters if they agree with the bishops calling the threat of abortion the preeminent priority and why they think it's important to vote.
Without the right to life, all other rights disappear. If you're not alive, what rights do you have? So it's the most important, moral issue. It's not just a political issue or a political football, it's a moral issue.
I think the bishops know what they're talking about. We all know, we see the atmosphere and we see the environment, and we have to step up to the plate and have our voices heard.
As Catholics, we have certain beliefs, certain traditions, and we have certain values that, you know, dictate our lives and how we live it, how we act with other people. And it's important to vote because in voting that reflects like those values that we hold in life.
Russell Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Remember, every vote counts. If you would like more information about the USCCB's voter guide, you can read Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship and this year's new introductory note on the USCCB's website.
Well, we gotta speak the language of the kids, you know, what is going on, to help evangelize them, to help bring them closer to Jesus.
Contemplating the priesthood at the age of 13, ordained at 25, a bishop at 45, America's youngest Catholic bishop brings his own unique perspective on how to reach the next generations of Catholics. Our conversation next.
Hey everybody, my name is Father Joseph Espaillat, aka Father J. We are presenting to you this brand new podcast. Check it out, Sainthood in the City.
Talking to young people up front and direct. We introduce you to Father J, or Bishop Joe, whose electrifying evangelization is making big inroads in New York City. The Most Reverend Joseph Espaillat is the pastor of St. Anthony of Padua Catholic Church in the Bronx and director of the Hispanic Catholic Charismatic Center there. 2 years ago, Pope Francis appointed him as an auxiliary bishop for the Archdiocese of New York, making him the youngest Catholic bishop in the United States at the age of 45. Bishop Espaillat is known for his mission and outreach to young people. In addition to his own youthful persona, he brings to the priesthood. He recently gave me a tour of his parish in what he calls the Boogie Down Bronx and spoke to me about the connection he's able to make with the next generations of Catholics, all inspired from his own experience as a child growing up in Manhattan with parents and a grandmother who modeled a strong Hispanic faith tradition, and his experience in high school at Cathedral Preparatory Seminary.
It was awesome because I got to see a priest day in, day out, what he did, his prayer life. You know, he ate ice cream. He would go to the movies.
He was normal.
He was normal, yeah. And I'm like, that's pretty cool. Yeah. Like, that's an interesting life, you know?
Yeah.
And it was that moment, like, where I was like, maybe God is calling me to become a priest.
Having committed to the possibility of becoming a priest when he enrolled in his high school at the age of 13, Bishop Espaillat followed his vocation and was ordained at 25. Bishop Espaillat brings Latino enthusiasm to his work, inspired by God, with a heavy dose of spice from his family heritage in the Dominican Republic. He's America's youngest Catholic bishop. Bishop Joseph Espaillat is on the record.
You work with a remarkable number of young people, mm-hmm. and have really picked up in your, you know, 18 months as a bishop, your tenure has really been focused on evangelizing young people.
Yes.
And we're here physically next to El Centro Carismático,
yes.
the Charismatic mm-hmm. Catholic Center. A lot of people hear charismatic and they don't think Catholic.
Right.
So let's start there. Tell me a little bit about the charismatic movement in the Catholic Church and why it's so important to have it here.
This is a gem of the church. This is a gem of the Archdiocese of New York. We see at least 6,000 souls a year that come in. We have 200 beds and people from all over. I mean, Monte, all over. I'm talking about California, Virginia, Africa.
Wow.
Come to the Charismatic Center. It is a real hidden gem. I'll be very honest with you, blunt as it is, I was not charismatic at all. I was the St. Paul, Saul, because I was like, these charismaniacs. I'm like, what's up with that? I'm like, I'm not down with it. And here's the thing. I was the director of youth ministry. A lot of people maybe don't make the connection, mm-hmm. but Cardinal Dolan, when he came to New York City, he came to New York to the Archdiocese. He named me the director of youth ministry. And then I was loving it. I mean, I was going all over the place, getting information on how to open this office. You know, they didn't train me in the seminary to be, hey, open up an office of youth ministry. No. So I figured it out, you know, by going and traveling around the country and getting the best practices of all of the different dioceses. And then all of a sudden it was like, hey, I want you to go to St. Anthony of Padua Church. Have you heard of it? And I'm like, El Centro?
Yeah.
And then he's like, yeah. And I'm like, with the charismatics? And I'm like, oh no, you got the wrong guy. And then he says to me, no, I got the right guy. I want you to go. And I've said this, you know, before, some people know the story already, but God has a funny sense of humor. God has always, the way he's worked in my life is just amazing. And I've seen it. I decided, hey, I got to do a retreat. And so I went to the University of Steubenville, Franciscan University,
yes.
rather, out in Steubenville. I didn't know it was charismatic. And it was out there eventually that I was baptized in the Spirit. And that was before starting as the director of the Charismatic Renewal Hispanic Catholic Charismatic Center here. And so I've grown into this, and to see people come from all over, like, you know, we're getting a lot of the immigrants now too, mm-hmm. who are coming, the destitute, fearful, looking for faith. And it's been just beautiful and edifying. These last 8 years have been just wonderful here. Because it's changed the trajectory of my spirituality and everything else. And I've grown exponentially.
Your community is also feeding you as you feed them.
Absolutely.
100%.
It's incredible.
Yes, 100%.
A lot of people, I know you hear this now at the Bishops' Conference, going to their gatherings, they're worried about the future of the church. They think about young people and the percentage of young people that are Latino and mm-hmm. how the future of the church is Latino. I say the church already is.
It is now. Thank you. Yes,
Latino.
That's what I tell people, right?
But you're right in the thick of it.
Yes.
And some people ask the question of, well, how do we actually minister to these communities? Should we have Mass in different languages? Should we only have Mass in English? Should retreats be bilingual or not? And yet we're sitting here in a church that used to be for German migrants.
Correct.
And Absolutely. Above the altar, you have a bilingual statement of praise to our Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So give us some advice.
We have to speak the language of the people. And it's not hard, Monse. Let's follow the example of Jesus, right? Jesus spoke in the language of the people, and he used the images that they knew, and he used the analogies that they would understand. One of my favorite saints, St. Ignatius of Loyola, because I was Jesuit trained at Fordham, he said, we cannot evangelize without speaking the language of the people. And so... Are we speaking their language? You know, are we speaking the language of the people? And I'm not just referring to English, Spanish. I'm talking about the idioms as well. You know, you may know this, of course, but it's like whenever I get introduced, people say, oh, he speaks three languages. He speaks English, Spanish, and street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I know what the young kids are saying out there. Well, you know, the culture and this and that. You got to understand the culture if you want to understand the young people. And this has been through history, right? I'm a history major. You know, we seem to forget that as we grow older. But we got to speak the language of the kids. You know, what is going on to help evangelize them, to help bring them closer to Jesus. So my first suggestion is learn the language of the kids, learn the culture, learn what's going on. Not that you have to agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you're going to be rocking to their music or whatever it is, but at least it's a starting block. No, it's a starting cell. Meet them where they're at, right? That's what Jesus did. He mm-hmm. met the Samaritan woman where she was at. You know, he met the leper where he was at. And many times as church, we can want people to be at a certain level, but they're not. You know, we have to go there. And that's what Pope Francis talks about, right? Acompañamiento, accompaniment. I see a lot of hope for the future. I do, personally. I've seen it working with young people. They're hungering. And we have kind of backed off. You know, we have kind of been fearful. And we don't want to kind of approach them and or minister to them. Or maybe think even worse, they don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lie. It is a total lie of the enemy. They want to hear the truth. They want more. And so we have to do a better job as church and not be afraid. Not be afraid of approaching them and ministering to them and being with them and accompanying them, because that's what they want.
Bishop Joe, you're also part of the Eucharistic Revival. What does the Eucharist mean to you?
Wow. The Eucharist is everything. The Eucharist is life. The Eucharist is Jesus. No, this is what we believe. It's who we are. We are a Eucharistic people.
Mm.
It's not only the body of Christ, as in Eucharist, body, blood, soul, and divinity, but it is the mystical body of Christ. It is the church gathering together, right? And we don't speak about that often enough, right? And that's what I've been really praying with, because people are like, well, yeah, you know, I don't go to church anymore, or I don't go to Mass. You're part of that mystical body, and when one part is missing, we all suffer. We all hurt.
How do you expect to bring your young people into the Eucharist? How do you talk to them about our Lord in the Eucharist?
We need to, as church, you know, and then all of us, you know, from the top down and the bottom up, come to a deeper awareness of what the Mass is. It is a celebration. It is a celebration, a joyful celebration at that. in which we come together. There's music, right? There's food. There's the best food of all. And I always say this, especially to young people, because that was the question.
Yeah.
How do I speak to young people about it? How do you go to a party and then not eat? Like, could you imagine, Monte?
My mom would kill me.
Exactly. Right. And that's the same with me. Like, you know, my mom slaved in the kitchen all day making, you know, chivo, you know what I'm saying? Or making, like, tamales.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you're like, oh, sorry, I'm not going to eat today. How do you think God the Father feels when he offers us his son? When he offers us the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus? When we reject him. And that, when you speak in that manner, you know, to young people, it clicks. Mm-hmm. They get it. They want to hear more. They want to be engaged. And as church, we need to do a better job helping young people come back to the feet of Jesus. Since being named bishop, I've had a lot of young people just say, hey, you know what? I can relate to you.
That's right.
You know, I can see myself in you. And that's a positive. That's a great sign because then they know, hey, there's more or there can be more. And that's what we're called to do, right?
That's right. Well, it's why we wanted to be here with you today and why I pestered you so much for this interview. So thank you so much for giving it to me.
Amen.
There is much more of my conversation with Bishop Espaillat, his Catholic formation as a child, the influence of his beloved grandmother and parents, and more thoughts on the Eucharistic revival, not to mention what he expects to eat when he goes to heaven. He should go to heaven, God willing, we all will, and what he says might be waiting for me in Mary's kitchen. The full interview is posted on the EWTN YouTube page. Up next, we look ahead at the big event next week in Washington, the March for Life. Headlines are next in the Week in Review. Gearing up for our nation's largest pro-life event tops the Week in Review. We're just 1 week away from the 51st annual March for Life in Washington, D.C., an event that draws tens of thousands from across the country. Everyone from students to seniors, Republicans and Democrats, Christian and secular, will be taking part in this advocacy event for the unborn. As we can see in this video from last year's march, the event was still packed, even after the overturning of Roe v. Wade. The theme of this year's march is With Every Woman for Every Child. The president of the March for Life tells us why this theme is so important.
The truth is that this is at the heart of what it means to be pro-life. And whereas sometimes the pro-life movement is mischaracterized as being only for the baby in the womb, the truth is that we're very much pro-woman and pro-child, and we accompany women so that they and the babies can fully flourish in life.
Be sure to tune in to our extensive coverage of this year's march next Friday, January 19th. We will be talking about every angle of the pro-life issue, from legal to scientific to cultural. More than 6 hours of coverage, defending life right here on EWTN. On Monday, Pope Francis called for the end of what he called the despicable practice of surrogate motherhood and the commercialization of pregnancy. His comments came during his annual foreign policy speech to ambassadors to the Holy See, in which he lists what he sees as threats to global peace and human dignity.
La via della pace esige il rispetto della vita.
The path to peace calls for respect for life, for every human life, starting with the life of the unborn child in the mother's womb, which cannot be suppressed or turned into an object of trafficking. In this regard, I deem deplorable the practice of so-called surrogate motherhood, which represents a grave violation of the dignity of the woman and the child, based on the exploitation of situations of the mother's material needs.
The Pope has previously voiced his opposition to what he has called uterus for rent, surrogacy in some European countries do prohibit it, including Spain and Italy. Pope Francis baptized 16 babies in the Sistine Chapel last Sunday in what has become an annual tradition near the end of Christmas, saying baptism is the most beautiful gift that parents can give to their children. The Catechism calls baptism the basis of the whole Christian life, the gateway to life in the Spirit. Later in the day, during his weekly Angelus address, the Pope advised the faithful to know the date of their baptism and celebrate it as the anniversary of becoming a child of God. There's been another court ruling in the ongoing sexual abuse cases involving former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. On Wednesday, a judge in Wisconsin suspended the criminal prosecution of McCarrick on clergy sex abuse charges when he found him incompetent to stand trial because of dementia. The 93-year-old former Archbishop of Washington, D.C., was also charged with sexual assault in Massachusetts and was found mentally unfit in that case last year. The ruling this week now likely brings to an end all efforts to prosecute him. In 2019, McCarrick became the first cardinal to be defrocked after a Vatican investigation of his decades-long sexual abuse of minors and adult seminarians. He now lives at a Missouri facility for troubled priests. A mass this week at the Vatican to mark the first anniversary of the death of Cardinal George Pell, who was at one time the third highest-ranking official at the Vatican and leader of the Catholic Church in Australia. Pell rose to become one of the most respected members of the College of Cardinals under multiple popes. Pope Francis named him the inaugural prefect of the Secretariat for the Economy in 2014, responsible for overseeing the Vatican's annual budget. But in 2018, in a conviction that was later overturned, Pell was accused of sexual abuse charges in Australia, charges he vigorously denied. He served time in prison before his release in 2020. Viewers of EWTN News In Depth will remember that Cardinal Pell appeared in several interviews on this program after his release from the Australian prison and his return to Rome. He spoke to us about the prison journal he kept while in solitary confinement. And in the days after the death of Pope Benedict, he sat down with our Colin Flynn to reflect on the Holy Father, who he knew very well.
There'll be much debate and analysis about his life and legacy. But what do you think his legacy should be?
Well, you see, he died principally, he died, you know, from old age. But he was Pope. Now, what's the role of the Pope? It's not to be the great Catholic preacher. It's not to be the big television star. Most popes in history had nothing like the theatrical and public leadership capacities of John Paul II. The Pope has a scriptural role. He's the man of rock. He's the successor of Peter. He's the foundation of the church. He's the guarantor that the people in the pews are receiving the same teachings that the Christ and the apostles gave, and that the unity of the church, 1.4, 3 or 4 billion Catholics, is built around the figure of Christ and the apostolic tradition. Now, in these terms, Benedict was a magnificent success. He realized that the secrets of our vitality are in the redemptive activity and teaching of Jesus Christ. That was his job. Now, he wasn't the greatest administrator, greatest executive, not a natural politician, not a backslapper as in the Irish-American tradition, but he did what he was supposed to, and that is to strengthen the faith of his brothers. It's not to entertain the non-believers or those who have rejected what we're about. They're an important constituency. We must try to reach them. But what is important is to reassure the people in the pews.
Finally, if you were to summarise Pope Benedict as a person and his papacy in one word, what would it be?
Well, let me give two words. A Christian disciple.
Cardinal Pell spoke to Colum in Rome right before he concelebrated Pope Benedict's funeral in St. Peter's Square. And within days of this interview, he himself died of heart complications following a long-planned hip operation at a Rome hospital. We're grateful we were able to capture his perspective and insights from his long life in the church. As we did earlier in this program, we turn our attention next to the future of the church, our youth, as we share inspirational encounters with faith.
So many young adult Catholics here. Does the future of the church look bright from what you're seeing?
The answer to that, as we wade into the crowds at the annual SEEK conference in St. Louis, next.
What can bring more than 18,000 young people from around the country under one roof for adoration, Mass, and a celebration of the Eucharist? Well, none other than the SEEK conference, sponsored by the campus ministry Focus. That's where reporter Mark Iron spoke to hundreds of young people inspired by their faith or in the conventions that are looking for answers. From the conference in St. Louis, here's this week's Faith Journey in Depth.
What attracted nearly 20,000 young adults here to St. Louis starting on the first day of the year?
Look at the world around us.
For them, 2024 began with a search for something more. For a week, the downtown streets and the inside of this arena and convention center were crowded with many college-age Catholics from around the country.
It feels like electric, like the energy's just up.
I would describe it as heaven on earth because there's no mean people here. Everybody is loving and caring.
Some even traveled from around the world to be here, but they all came to SEEK.
What do you think of SEEK so far?
I really like it. It's been crazy because I've never seen so many Catholics in one place.
This annual conference provides a place for young people to converge, along with religious sisters and brothers, bishops, and hundreds of seminarians and priests.
If you were to meet somebody on the street and they say, what is SEEK? What is SEEK? What's it all about?
I would say it's just a hub for all things Catholic that you can come and deepen your faith.
I would describe SEEK as a lot of young adults who may not actually know each other coming together, and you could have a conversation with anybody and it would be like you know them because you have that one similar thing in common of Jesus.
The Lord bringing them all together.
I will bless the Lord who gives me counsel.
Every day, attendees packed together for the celebration of Mass. And just days removed from Christmas, the sounds of welcoming Christ into the world echoed throughout the arena.
The whole arena was just filled with song.
College freshman Dawson Heemstra came to further develop his spiritual life.
I'm here, this is my first SEEK, and I'm ready for something more. Like, I just want to keep digging into my faith.
There were plenty of opportunities for that.
All of your hopes, all of your dreams, all your sufferings, your broken heart gets placed on that altar too.
With more than 100 Catholic speakers throughout the week presenting on a wide variety of faith-based topics, students like Katie Ferguson were given much to take note of.
Do you think a Catholic that comes to SEEK will leave a better informed Catholic?
Oh, absolutely. At every single talk I've been to, my horizons have already expanded.
You know, I've been on my feet numerous times during some of these talks, just getting me amped up to continue my prayer life after this.
Just having speakers like giving great advice, things that you can take back to your campus or parish.
That willingness to listen and receive noticed by the speakers.
It's wonderful because the benefit and privilege of youth is that they're open to the gospel.
Simone Rizcala, a special advisor with the Philos Project, gave a talk titled The Epidemic of Loneliness and the Eucharist.
The remedy to the epidemic of loneliness is the Eucharist. One is about isolation, one's about union.
And union around the Eucharist was felt in a powerful way at SEEK. Midway through the week, more than 20,000 people gathered for adoration.
Jesus says, I know my sheep, and the sheep hear the voice of the shepherd. Adoration is really conducive to that. We're tired of being on our phones all the time. We're tired of the perfectionism that comes with maybe school or work. And we just want to be like loved in our being. And being at Eucharistic Adoration is a place of dignity, because God isn't judging you on how rich you are, how, you know, powerful you are, how good looking you are, all these things that our culture really worships. Even when I don't see it's your work. It's just you and the Lord. And so it's a place of dignity, because it's a re-encounter with your identity as a beloved son or daughter.
The Blessed Sacrament processed around the arena floor and into the stands, passing by kneeling students.
It just brought me to tears, because there was just 20,000 young adults, people my age, adoring one Lord.
The Sikh Conference is put on by the Fellowship of Catholic University Students, known as FOCUS. The group places young adult missionaries on college campuses. By forming friendships and intentional community, they invite students to encounter Christ. A FOCUS missionary had a major impact on Amaru Duffy, a student at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette.
And then I ended up meeting Matt, the missionary there for FOCUS, and man, he changed my life.
What started as a long conversation about God would lead Amaru back to the church after he had planned to leave. And now he shares a hopeful message.
If you're depressed, feeling lonely, I was once in your shoes, and I'm telling you that God is the way out. The Lord Jesus Christ is the way out.
Along with receiving Christ in the Eucharist, Sikh attendees also had the chance to receive his forgiveness. Hundreds of priests were on hand offering the sacrament of confession. Long, winding lines of young Catholics formed, eager to receive the mercy of God.
There's over 400 priests hearing confessions for hours.
Tom Bruner, a vice president with FOCUS, oversees planning of the Sikh Conference. This year in particular saw record turnout. He says the annual goal remains the same.
How do we really bring people to that authentic encounter with Jesus? How do we bring them to know Jesus and his church?
Along with that central question, there were other logistical concerns, like where to store all the priests' vestments for Mass. This arena was once home to the Super Bowl champion St. Louis Rams football team. So the vestments hung in the old football locker rooms. Among the clergy attending Sikh, a cardinal.
Cardinal Dolan, what is it like to be here in this crowd?
Catholic means everybody. Everybody. You see that here. It's the mystical body of Christ as we define the church. And you kind of see that alive here at Sikh.
At the conference, there was also space set aside for Catholic apostolates to showcase all the services they provide along Mission Way. And there were plenty of priests and religious women and men to share with students.
This part of the conference center is dedicated completely to religious life. Discerning Catholics have a chance to talk to priests, religious sisters or brothers, and get a feel for their way of life.
Yeah, I'm kind of in like a kind of confusing spot.
For someone like Sebastian DeRozier, Sikh offered a chance to continue discerning where God is calling him.
Just trying to figure out like what my next step should be, whether it is priesthood or trying to start a family, like what my vocation should be.
Time to reflect and pray was combined with space for fun, fellowship, and entertainment. Alongside a game of pickleball, we caught up with Mother Olga, foundress of the Daughters of Mary of Nazareth. Her message to young Catholics throughout the week was one of trust and surrender to God.
When we know who He is, the one we are surrendering to, it gives us peace of mind that wherever He leads us, it will be a happy and peaceful place.
On the final day of Sikh, Catholic evangelist Chris Stefanik gave the keynote address.
It's growing leaps and bounds. It's incredible.
He's seen this conference gain more and more interest over the years. The message he gave is timeless.
Talked about the core message of the gospel, how it is the best news in human history, and how when people forget that, they forget who they are and what the purpose of life is.
And we met recent college graduate Savannah Hernandez, who summed it all up, hoping to show other young people that Jesus is the way, truth, and life.
I've gone the route of trying to be just so involved in the secular things and what the secular culture is saying. Like, this is fun. This is what's going to, give you life and make you feel fulfilled and find your identity. But it's not. It's so lonely. It's so crippling. And it's so easy to get lost in that. But I know that in times when I've been the best in my faith, consistent in prayer life, I have felt so seen, so loved, so fulfilled.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Next week at this time, the EWTN Network will bring you a major event of the year when we replay our coverage for the March for Life in Washington, D.C. and other pro-life programming. We hope you'll join us in Washington, D.C. or from your homes starting at 9:30 a.m. Eastern next Friday. EWTN News In Depth will be back the following week. I hope to see you then.